Welcome to Beyond the Habit.
Moving beyond everyday assumptions of what it means to be Catholic and live the gospel with two Catholic sisters.
Who are trying to find common ground, create unity, and talk about real life issues.
Led by two sisters of St. Joseph.
That's us. I'm Sister Erin McDonald.
And I'm Sister Colleen Gibson.
Hey Colleen, I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing good. I know Marcella, the sister you live with, Marcella, who people will know from previous episodes, I think an Advent episode. Marcella's been away, right?
Yes, correct.
How have you been faring?
Listen, isn't that a great question? So yes, she's been gone for a few days. She's a spiritual director. She's been out sharing her spiritual sageness with others in the world and has left me at home to my own devices.
You've been holding down the fort.
Yes. You know, it's sort of like the joys and challenges of living alone for a few days. And so, yeah, as many of you know, like typically as Catholic sisters, we live in community with other sisters, sometimes with other associates and others connected to our congregation. And so it's rare that many of us really have alone time at home, because often we live in community with two and three and four and sometimes up to five others. And so often it's like really rare moments to kind of be completely alone in the house, especially for a couple of days. And I do have a few personal musings on that. You know, I am deeply aware that I have appreciation for that alone time. I mean, what a beautiful opportunity to recharge the batteries a little bit, you know, some space to breathe and appreciate the quiet and the ability to just move about. I know you're an introvert, Colleen, so I'm sure you appreciate those little quiet moments in community, right?
Well, I think they're so rare. Right now, I live with, you know, three other sisters, but one is retired. So on my day off, which is a day during the week, oftentimes it's not like, oh, I get the house to myself. There's somebody else around. And so it's always nice to have somebody else to talk to. And the community keeps us accountable, I think, mm-hmm. too. Like I would not be, you know, like dusting or, you know, vacuuming on the regular. But because I know I live with other people and like I share a shower with somebody else, I should probably like clean the shower more than if it was just me taking care of that. But I hear you, like, you know, that sense of like when you live with a lot of people. At one point I lived with nine other sisters and there was, you never, I think once in the 3.5 years that I was there, I got the house to myself and it was like a moment, like a Home Alone moment, like the movie Home Alone. I was like, wait, what? Like, let me check all the rooms. Maybe somebody's still here. There's got to be somebody here. What do I do with myself?
Absolutely. I mean, so true. And, you know, as you're talking too about sort of the ways you find out that, you know, you slack a lot more when you don't have that accountability from community. And so the more probably spiritual interpretation is, you know, community invites me to always be kind of my best self and, you know, to be growing and in love of God and neighbor. And yeah, you know, left at home to my own devices, it was sort of like, wow, do I have to do dishes? I don't know. I mean, it's just me. Like, what do I, you know, maybe I do, maybe I don't. And, you know, also realizing like without that, like there is a level of self-awareness of how easily I can just kind of slide into like, oh, gee, you know, so some more snacks for me. So I was like warning Sister Marcella when she was on her way home. By the way, we might need to go to the grocery store. I've eaten all the snacks while you were gone. You know, it's like, what does my dinner consist of? You know, maybe it's hummus and pretzels. I don't know. Nobody's home. Diet Coke and hummus it is for dinner.
Yeah, that moment of like, of saying like, could you text me when you're on your way back? Because I may have left all of my papers out on the kitchen table.
Yeah.
Because it's really convenient. Like I don't have a desk in my room. So like, it's really convenient to use that space, but like, I don't want you walking in and me like looking like, you know, a conspiracy theorist who has papers everywhere is like, you know, planning world domination. But really, it's just I was doing something and I didn't feel like cleaning up my paper. So could you just call, maybe like you said, maybe you could pick up like eggs and milk.
Yeah, right.
You know, that'll buy me some extra time. But also, I've drank all the milk and I've rationed out the half and half for the number of days I have.
Correct.
That I don't have to go to the store.
Right. But I did no rationing with the snacks. No. All right.
You got to plan, sister. You got to plan ahead.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, in these moments of going, gosh, you know, if I lived alone all the time, I might just, you know, totally slide right into the seven deadly sins here. You know, it's like total sloth mode. What am I doing? So, you know, in some ways it's wonderful that probably Sister Marcella doesn't travel and leave too often. But, you know, it is also just that profound sense of accountability in a very positive, loving way. You know, that sense of I belong, we belong to one another, and I care about the others in my community and to live in right relationship with one another and sort of not just in that household in which we share an address and live in intentional Christian community, but in that wider circle of church family and human family, like how all of that, even in the silly levels, does translate into, you know, that deep sense of interconnectedness with all of God's creation and how to live in right relationship to that. And that when I fall into the temptation of that individualistic mindset, it can lead to, you know, not a lot of great things for me personally and us as community and us as, you know, collective creations of God.
Amen. And I think, you know, speaking of right relationship, for our listeners out there, if you know any of the sisters who we live with, please just tell them to forward through this first 5 minutes of the episode, because, you know, all in good and fun. I think we all do it. I'm sure that when I'm away, my sisters are doing other things too. It's a uniquely hashtag nun problems. It is a unique thing, but I think 100% it's about accountability and that community calls us to be our best selves. But also we love the sisters who we live with, and they help to, you know, make sure we eat a balanced diet and take care of ourselves.
Facts.
Well, today we have a great conversation with Dr. Tia Noel Pratt, and we're happy to have her join us in community. So let's get to it. Today, we're talking with Dr. Tia Noel Pratt, Assistant Vice President for Mission Engagement and Strategic Initiatives, and Assistant Professor of Sociology at Villanova University. Tia is a sociologist of religion and has based her research on how systemic racism impacts African-American Catholic identity. She is also the curator of the Black Catholic Syllabus and editor of the Journal of Catholic Social Thought.
Tia attended Chestnut Hill College for her undergraduate degree in sociology, and then earned her PhD in sociology from Fordham University. She is currently working on a book entitled Faithful and Devoted, Racism and Identity in the African-American Catholic Experience. Her writings and research have been featured in Commonweal, Faithfully, and America magazines, as well as the National Catholic Reporter. We are so excited to be in conversation with Tia today.
Welcome, Tia.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, it is great to have you. And we just heard that illustrious introduction of you. But we love to, when we start a conversation with people, kind of say like, hey, Tia, you do a lot of stuff. And we've heard that you're in lots of places and lots of different worlds. You know, you're in academia, you're in this space of the Twitterverse doing the Black Syllabus or the Xverse, I guess that's what it is now. You're in all of these different places. But maybe just like, how do you introduce yourself or how do you talk about like what you do?
That's a great question. So I talk about what I do. Honestly, it depends on who's asking the question. You know, professionally speaking, first and foremost, I see myself as a sociologist. Sociology very much influences and sets the parameters for how I do the work that I do, whether it is the scholarly work, the practitioner work, because I do very much see myself as a scholar practitioner. And that's where not just, you know, my research, my writing, but, you know, my work in the community and, you know, constantly pushing that Boulder, up the mountain, you know, to do the anti-racism work in so many different spaces. But sociology very much, you know, sort of colors how I see the world and how I do that. So professionally speaking, first and foremost, I see myself as a sociologist. I am a sociologist of religion that happens to be working in a full-time administration role as an assistant vice president at Villanova. But this position does allow me to teach. Usually once a year, I get to teach my course on African-American Catholics, which I'm very glad to be able to do that for the sociology department and for the university. And so that's how I see it. Yeah. But, you know, all that stuff that you said, now I know why I'm so tired.
That's a very fair point. What inspired you to go into the work of sociology, and especially this intersectional sociology and, you know, church and racism? What kind of drew you to this particular arena of ministry and work?
So there's two questions there. How I came to sociology and how I came to be the sociologist that I am. Mm-hmm. So how I came to sociology is... I think it's a very interesting story. So when I was a high school student at West Catholic High School in Philadelphia, I was leaving, was I a junior? I was a junior and I was leaving third period English class and going to fourth period German class. And I thought to myself, I think I'll major in sociology. I had no idea what sociology was. But it just came to me one day in the corridors of West Catholic. But as I learned more about it, I thought this was something that I wanted to do. And then as a senior, I went to Accept a Student's Day at Chestnut Hill and sat in on an intro to sociology class. And I knew then what I already knew, which was that this was for me. And the lesson that day was on George Herbert Mead and the I and the me, which I won't get into what all that is, but that was the lesson of the day. And once I started teaching Mead, that was what I did. That's how I taught it to my students. And the professor who taught the class, I realized many years later that I never told him that his lesson on the I and the me that I still used all those years later, I finally did tell him. And so I'm glad for that, because I'm a great believer in telling people what they've meant to you and not waiting till their funerals to say all those wonderful things. Hmm. Okay, so that's how I came to sociology, how I came to sociology of religion. So as I was kind of finishing up my time at Chestnut Hill and trying to figure out what I was going to do next, I started getting into more about Black Catholics, more understanding this myth that exists, that there's no such thing as Black Catholics, and taking it as my personal mission to smash that myth. But also thinking about how I was going to do that. I thought I wanted to be a theologian. And then I learned that there was this thing called sociology of religion that I could do. And I realized that's really what I wanted to do, that I didn't want to be a theologian. I wasn't in my heart and my soul a theologian. I was a sociologist who was interested in understanding religion. And so I looked for graduate programs where I could do that and landed at Fordham.
Wow, that's amazing, Tia. I think that like epiphany moment in the corridors at West Catholic to see like, oh, where did it lead you? You know, tracing kind of the movements of the spirit. I can see you like the light bulb going off and then like, the, oh, what is this? What is sociology? I've got this word, you know, I think, but it speaks to like the nature of call. I think so often we tell our call stories, like, it's like, oh yeah, one day I just started thinking about being a sister. And I thought like, this is crazy. I don't even know what that means. Like, I start thinking like, oh, I've got this word sociology on my heart. What does that going to look like?
Yeah. And that's really kind of what it was. And then, you know, as I just got more and more into it, and then when I got to graduate school, and realized I could take sociology classes all the time. And this was going to be great. I mean, it wasn't always great because, I mean, that's just graduate school. But it was, it was just fantastic. And then getting more involved in the professional guilds, because sociologists of religion are just a rare breed. So we have to be able to find our people, and that's not always in the departments where we're studying or the departments where we're working once we finish our degrees. So those guilds and the friendships and colleagues from those spaces have been very important over the years.
Yeah. And I hear in that, like, Tia, like this, like, straddling as a sociologist of religion, like you straddle kind of both worlds. You're in one place and also you're in the sociology world. But then, like, the religion part does kind of, like, it's not theology, but like how you straddle that. And I wonder, almost as a sociologist, because you're also, like, you're studying Black Catholics, but you also are a member of the Black Catholic community. How do you straddle that? I mean, there's so much about, like, what advice would you give about how to straddle worlds? But, like, as a sociologist, how do you remain objective in, like, studying a group that you also belong to?
So, okay, there's about four questions there, Colleen.
So an abundance. Go run however you want with it, Tia.
Let me start with the sociology piece and sociology of religion piece. You know, for those of us who were in graduate school and did graduate training at the same time I did, one of the things we learned, and this was, you know, it wasn't limited to being at Fordham, it was everywhere. If you were going to be a sociologist of religion, you were told you had to have an and, religion and, because it was the and that was going to get you a job.
Oh, interesting.
And so I have friends that did sociology and aging, sociology and statistics. I mean, religion and statistics, religion and gender. I opted to do religion and race. I opted to have race as my and. So there's that straddling. But, you know, part of that and part of, you know, what I argue about is the lack of engagement with race that exists within the sociology of religion and the lack of engagement with religion that exists within the sociology of race. So that's something that I've been arguing for a long time as well. So in terms of, you know, the work, you know, when I started doing this work, there was very, very little, if anything, on sociology of religion that really was about Black Catholics. There was starting to be some work, but none of it was done within the confines of sociology done by somebody who was a Black Catholic. So there's that piece. So that meant I had to turn to theology. So I had to turn to the work of folks like Jamie Phelps and Brian Massengale and Sean Copeland and, you know, Father Cyprian Davis, who is, you know, a historian, but who wrote, you know, literally wrote the book on the history of Black Catholics in the United States. So it was their work that gave me the foundation to, you know, figure out what I was going to do and how to do it. So there's that straddling as well. And then there's the straddling of, you know, you used the word objectivity. I don't normally use that word because I don't think it's entirely possible. I mean, just the fact, you know, we talk about, you know, bias-free sociology was a phrase that was used all the time when I was in graduate school. There's no such thing, because just the fact that you're doing work on one area and not 80 million others that exist is some indication of bias. So you just have to embrace that. And I remember being in graduate school and a professor that I had taken a class with told me that I could not study my own religious tradition. And I looked at him and I said, watch me. And then I went up and got a drink, because this was at a party. And that was the other thing that the guilds helped me to see, to meet colleagues who were sociologists of religion studying their own tradition. And that's important because as sociologists, we study institutions. And so being able to be in the institution and then also study it is a matter of great import. And, you know, we can't, as sociologists, as people, we live in society. So we have to, you know, figure out how to do the work, but also understand that we live in this space as well as study it. And that's where our training comes in. That's where the sociological imagination comes in. And that's where we have to be mindful of how we're bringing that skill set as sociologists to the work.
in keeping with that, wanting to move a little more deeply into your work, because as you're talking, I'm thinking about one of the works you've written in terms of liturgy as identity. And I was reading that and was fascinated and felt like I learned so much, and wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about that in terms of as you're entering into these studies. I mean, I think some of what you pull out in this article is pretty incredible.
Yeah. So it's actually liturgy as identity work.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I talk about, one of the key things that I talk about in my work is how Black Catholics take the traditions of Roman Catholicism and the traditions of the African-American religious experience and put them together in a way that is, for the community, seamless. For those outside it, it might seem like these two things don't go together, but that's also part of the myth. For those who live in this space and worship in this space, these are things that very much go together. And in trying to kind of hone in on that sociologically, I draw on the work of a sociologist named Michelle Dillon, who wrote a book called Catholic Identity. And when did that come out? 1997, 1998, something like that. And chapter 5 of Catholic Identity was about research that Professor Dillon had done with Dignity USA groups in Boston in the 90s. The groups were in Boston. That's where she did the research. And she was talking about, you know, being LGBTQ and being Catholic are identities that didn't seem to go together, but these folks put them together. And it was a way of owning identity and owning identity differently. And, you know, there was a time in my life that I had committed sections of chapter 5 of Catholic Identity to memory. You know, the first time I met Michelle Dillon, I completely fangirled out. I said, I'm so excited to meet you, Michelle. Catholic Identity changed my life. She thought I was a little weird, but that's fine. But now she has, you know, been such a tremendous support over the years and helping me to get a better understanding of what she was doing in that work and how to apply it to my own work in terms of owning identity and in terms of, you know, putting together these two things that seem to be disparate, but they're not for those for whom it is who they are. And so in terms of how that happens, you know, I look at three areas: preaching, music, and church aesthetics, and how that comes together. And, you know, churches, particularly predominantly Black churches where I do most of this work, you know, how, say, in December, you'll go to these churches and there will be a Kwanzaa Kinara right next to the Advent wreath. And, you know, just as a way of aesthetically putting, you know, these two traditions together. Aesthetically, there are a number of other ways that happens, you know, especially when you have a predominantly Black parish that was not created to be one, but became one over the years as the surrounding neighborhood changed. So you've got paintings and stained glass and things that just aren't going to change of white saints and white Jesus, but they've brought in statues and, you know, the crucifix that the altar server carries, you know, at the beginning and end of Mass, you know, that are Black saints and Black Jesus and Black Mary, and putting those all those things together. So in terms of liturgy as identity work, you know, and how the preaching factors in, how the music factors in, the role of the Lead Me, Guide Me hymnal, which was first published in 1987, was a major turning point in how all of this began to take shape.
It's fascinating, Tia. And I think, you know, that idea of like owning identity, and I see it, you know, in your own work and even in you talking about like, we can't be bias free in the work that we do. Like, how do you own your own identity in the work that you're doing? And to, you know, counteract this myth that there aren't Black Catholics, you know, or, oh, they're only in, you know, Black parishes, predominantly Black parishes. And no, they're everywhere. And so recognizing that sense of owning identity. And I want to pick up a thread of, you know, you've done this work on the Black Catholic syllabus. And I've heard you when you've spoken before, you say like, you know, the work that you do is, you know, you're writing things that you would want to have read as a student.
Yeah.
And I wonder, like, is that part of what's behind the Black Catholic syllabus? Or can you just explain that project to our listeners? Because I think it's so beneficial, and it's part of owning identity, but also breaking down the myth and exposing, you know, everyone to this richness.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for asking about that. There are kind of a list of things that I need to add to that. So thanks for reminding me of that as well.
When you get off of this, you go update the list, okay?
So the Black Catholic syllabus, it came along in 2020, and it was really about making available, you know, these resources. You know, it was a time where folks who have been hearing about systemic racism for a long time but weren't paying attention were finally starting to pay attention. And so I thought, well, you know, what about if I had a way to just have all of these things in one place so that when folks called me, I could say, well, you know, I actually wrote all this stuff down and here it is. So that was one thing. But what it does is, first of all, it centers the work of Black Catholics about Black Catholics. And that is a key element of what I do. It wasn't always, because the gatekeepers, you know, just wouldn't let it happen, especially before I finished my doctorate. But, you know, now in the years since, I've been able to shift and be able to do my work in the way that I want to do it. I mean, there have been consequences for that. You know, Sister Thea Bowman talked about telling the true truth. You know, telling the true truth has consequences. And one of those consequences is folks don't want to publish your work because you only talk about Black folks. But in terms of the syllabus, it was a way of putting these things together, of highlighting and centering the work of Black Catholics. And also, if you look at it, with a few exceptions, everything is listed twice. It's listed in type of media, and it's listed under subject. So if you're looking for something that is history, it'll be there. But if you're looking for something that's a book chapter or a podcast or a short video, then it will be, you know, there as well. So, you know, because sometimes folks are looking for different things. They have different needs. Somebody wants a reading for class, or they want a short video that they can show in class. You know, so I wanted to be able to do that as well. And so it is this work of public scholarship. Public scholarship is something I think is very important, and I'm glad to have been able to get into that. You know, my dissertation mentor, Dr. James Kelly, often wrote for publications like America and Commonweal when I was in school. So I really saw from the earliest days that it could be done. And, you know, he had also, you know, taken a turn as president of the Association for Sociology of Religion. So being able to do both was something I could see being done. And, you know, that adage, if you can see it, then you can be it. So the syllabus, you know, it really is a way of highlighting the fact that these works do exist, that there is scholarship around this. And then by putting it there, then, you know, I could just direct folks there and then go on with, you know, writing the new stuff, writing the stuff that I wanted to read.
Yeah. And as you're talking, I'm wondering about how your experience of doing this work and this research and these connections, how it has lived in relationship with your own spiritual journey or your own prayer life, your own relationship with God. So, you know, what might you share with us in terms of how your personal spiritual journey has been impacted or influenced, enhanced, challenged by some of this work that you've done?
You know, I'll say this. The main ways that I conduct research, you know, I'm trained as a qualitative researcher. So it's either participant observation, like going to the churches, seeing what happens at mass, that sort of thing, but also interviews. And so I'm interviewing people for this book, and it's such a blessing to have people, you know, welcome me into their homes, into their lives, oftentimes cook for me, treat me like family, tell me about their experiences, and be glad to do so, even these painful, difficult things, oftentimes because nobody's ever asked them before. Nobody's ever asked them before what it's like to be Black in this church. And they've been Black and in this church their whole lives. But, you know, I then have to take all of that in, oftentimes take all of that pain in, and then turn it around and put it back out into the world as scholarship. And that's very hard. And that's why, that's one of the reasons why this book has taken so long, because sometimes I've just had to take a break. That's been hard. And also, you know, this work, it has sort of pulled the curtain back when you start to see the fact that there are 3 million Black Catholics in the United States. And in the grand scheme of how many Catholics there are, how many Black folks there are, that number is disproportionately low. Especially if you look at the parts of the country where there are lots of Black folks and there are lots of Catholic folks, there is a lot of overlap in those places. Mm-hmm. So then, again, why is the number so low? But 3 million people also isn't nobody. 3 million people is a lot of people. But one of the things that I have shifted to in my writing, in my sociological thinking about this, is yes, the number is disproportionately low, but it's actually high when you think about all of the things Black folks have gone through in this church. And the fact that we still count as 3 million speaks to the faithfulness and the devotion, which is where the title of the book comes from. So there's that piece. And a woman I interviewed talked about being Black Catholics, being faithful and devoted. And I was hoping that somebody would say something that would just make a great title. One day in South Philly, that happened. So that number is key. But then when you look at how few Black women religious there are, how few Black priests there are, how few Black deacons and men religious there are, you know, it that also speaks to why the number is what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at the church's role in slavery, and not just the global slave trade, but specifically slavery in the United States, which we have not fully reckoned with yet. There are still numerous religious congregations that have not done the work of reckoning with this. And there is indirect and direct benefit. We all know about the Jesuits and the direct benefit, and you know, the dissensions, the suppletions who've also directly benefited. But there's also indirect benefit. When people would join religious orders and they would come with dowries from their families, and those dowries included slaves, and the order then would sell the slaves immediately and then try and tell us, we never had slaves. Yeah, because you sold them right away and kept the money. So you're still benefiting from the horrors of the institution of slavery. And so until that is fully reckoned with, then we're not going to be able to have the conversation that we need to have.
And I think the fullness of that reckoning, Tia, you know, that it is the sale of slaves. It's also, you know, how parishes have been merged or shut down, or mm-hmm. you know, which parishes have been allowed to flourish mm-hmm. in certain ways. And we aren't even aware. I'm thinking of like Maureen O'Connell's, mm-hmm. you know, Undoing the Knots, talking about like the background of that history, mm-hmm. or Shannon D. Williams, you know, looking yeah. at that there were policies in religious congregations that, you know, women of color were not accepted or were redirected to other, mm-hmm. you know, other congregations. And I think there's a richness that Black Catholics offer to the church that makes the church even richer, but that we don't even realize the fullness of what needs to be reckoned with in the church, that like an everyday Catholic in the pews is not fully aware of what has been done, you know, what the church has done, and how systemic racism is intertwined in our own history and in our own story of faith.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. And, you know, that issue, and particularly the, you know, the issue of, you know, religious congregations and, you know, not admitting particularly Black women or redirecting them, as you said, to other orders, particularly, you know, when we're talking about orders like the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament that were founded to support Black and Native people, but for many, many years would not allow Black and Native women to join their ranks. Mm. Because then, of course, if Black and Native women are joining their ranks, then they have to be equals. Mm-hmm. But as long as you're keeping them out, then you don't have to see them as equals, even though serving those communities is a core tenet of the mission.
Yeah. Father Brian Massengale writes about some of that, that even for congregations that did accept men and or women into religious orders or the priesthood, you know, people of color, that even though they accepted them, they often weren't given equal access to theological training and studies in the same ways that their white counterparts were. So kind of even, you know, when folks were admitted, they often were not afforded the same opportunities as their white counterparts. And he spells that out, you know, really powerfully in his Racial Justice in the Catholic Church book, where he like breaks down the actual numbers of how many Black Catholic theologians, even, for example, you know, in proportion to like women religious and priests. And, you know, he kind of breaks down these numbers. It's powerful to see it in those very simple numbers form about, you know, kind of Black Catholic leadership in the church and how essential that is and how systemically our church has prevented people of color from accessing those places and spaces of being deacons, being priests, being sisters. But even when they did access those spaces, being denied the opportunity to enter into the same level of leadership and theology studies and writing and things like that, which is another part of the reckoning that that we need to be doing as a church and as religious orders, you know, to be looking at that systemic oppression that does exist within our church and in our religious orders, because that's, I think, an essential piece of all of this is, you know, what you're offering, what you're sharing is like, we've been excluding the voices and experiences of a very key part of our church, our faith community, you know, and we're not whole as a church, as a people, until we are, you know, doing this work and it creating, you know, this, this true sense of oneness.
Yeah. And it's funny you should mention systematic theologians. When at the time I did my dissertation, there were so few Black systematic theologians that I named them all. And, you know, as you were talking, Erin, it reminded me about that. And I named them all. And I remember contacting Dr. Diana Hayes, who at the time, and she's retired now, but at the time she was still on the faculty at Georgetown. I remember reaching out to her and I said, so this is who I've got on my list. Am I missing anybody? And it was so few. I mean, you could count them on your fingers, and I named them all in the dissertation. So just even that part of it is important. And I say a lot to folks, I said, look around, look at who's at your table. And who's not there, and then go and get them. And then when I look at, you know, so many organizations and faculties, and, you know, they still got all white boards and they've got all white departments and they got this and that. And I think, you know, at this point in time, do you not see it, or do you see it and not care? Because at this point in time, you know, not seeing it is really hard. I mean, you got to work at that. It's like getting an F in one of my classes. I mean, you got to work at that. My classes are designed for students to do well. So, you know, you got to work hard to fail one of my classes. You know, but at this point, you got to work hard not to see it. And so then, you know, do you see it and then just don't care? If that's the case, you know, I'm fine with folks admitting that, because at least I can respect that. Don't gaslight me, because I've seen Gaslight. That's one of my favorite movies. I've seen Gaslight a bunch of times. I can see a gaslight coming a mile away. And, you know, not for nothing, if you've never seen a Charles Boyer movie, do not let Gaslight be your first one, because you will hate him. Watch the original Love Affair from the 1930s with him and Irene Dunne. Watch that first, then watch Gaslight. Just a little PSA.
Well, thank you for that, Tia. Really, I think it's, how do we hold one another accountable? And how do we, you know, hold our feet to the fire, is to say, we got work to do. And, and are we willing to do it? And I think the sadness of when, for you to say, if you're not willing to do it, well, then just tell me that, because that will, you know, help me to move forward in some ways.
Yeah. And I've had to tell people, you know, if you're not going to be in this, just go sit down and get out of my way, because I am here to do the work.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the work. It's the work for all of us to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you're doing that work. We're doing that work. Everybody should be doing that work. And so how do we remain engaged in conversation, and more than just conversation? You know, that's like a starting point to even be talking about it, but then say, like, you can't just talk about it. You have to be about it, which means showing up and doing. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And these are not things that happen in the abstract. These are things that happen in, how do you do your hiring? How do you do your recruitment for events? Who do you invite to be your speakers for different events? Who do you have on your boards? Who's working in your chancery office? Why is it that Black leadership, and I've said this so many times, I sound like a broken record. Why is it that Black leadership begins and ends in the Office of Black Catholics in so many of our chancery offices, if there even still is an Office of Black Catholics? Because in so many dioceses, there isn't one anymore. So there are all of these ways that we can do this work. And then, you know, if you're just not willing to, then, you know, just say so. Just, you know, put the sign out front. We're not willing to do this. We just like being, you know, how we are. And then I can keep on going. And I can just, you know, pass you by, because it's not like this train is leaving the station. This train has left the station.
Mm.
And so for folks who opt not to be on it, you know, that's fine. But, you know, just admit it and don't tell me it's raining when the sun is out.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I think kind of as a final note, I mean, so much of what you're sharing resonates on a lot of levels. And certainly as Sisters of St. Joseph, our charism is rooted in unioning love, you know, the words of Jesus himself, to love one another as I have loved you. But love also, I think sometimes we kind of water that word down a lot too. Like, it isn't just, hey, you know, be kind to the person sitting next to you or give someone a hug who's crying. It's like, what does that love in action look like? Like, how are we also applying that to not just my own personal thoughts and actions, but also kind of communal and systemic, both, you know, in the church structures and in our societal structures, that, you know, kind of loving God and neighbor without distinction calls us to all of that. And so, you know, kind of that's the invitation is, how am I, as a Catholic, as a follower of Jesus, really striving to live into that radical sense of love and unity and deep interconnectedness with all of God's creation, which requires doing the work of justice and equity and really addressing the ways in which parts of our family are, you know, being excluded and suffering. And so kind of reflecting on our charism a bit as you're offering those, you know, final kind of thoughts and challenges. And so I don't know if you have a final thought for us in relationship to kind of this charism of Sisters of St. Joseph. I know you've had a long relationship with the Sisters of St. Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a final, you know, kind of thought or nugget of wisdom there before we transition.
So in terms of a final thought, I mean, you know, the beautiful language that you just shared is empty unless there is action behind it. So that's why I talk about things like hiring and board leadership and, you know, who's on your faculty. And if those things don't reflect the beautiful language you just shared, then it's hollow. So my invitation would be to look around, you know, where are you posting your jobs? Who's at the board meetings? Who's working in the offices? And really think about that.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Well, Tia, thank you so much. I mean, for I think that call to action, but for all the ways in which you are present in these spaces and writing the stuff that needs to be there that you wish you would have read.
Mm-hmm.
Also doing the hard work in something that I read by you early on in this project of Faithful and Devoted. You said essentially, like, I may lose my religion, by the end of this, you know?
Yeah.
But it's, I think, listening to you speak and just being with you, like, it is a labor of love. Mm-hmm. Like, it is not just, this is not just a thought exercise, or this is not just the pursuit of scholarship. This is the pursuit of something much larger. I mean, in theological terms, like, it's the pursuit of the reign of God. But thank you for showing up in all the ways that you show up, and in making resources available, and in calling forth, you know, that action on the part, and for, you know, for being on the train and calling people, like, if the train is leaving, if you hurry, you might be able to jump on and get going. So thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for that. That's lovely. And thank you for reminding me about those words I wrote a while ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's get a little lighter. Let's transition into our lightning round. So, Tia, I know, and our listeners may not know, but you collect Pez dispensers. And so what is your favorite Pez dispenser today?
So my favorite Pez dispenser has always been my favorite Pez dispenser, and that is my OG Wonder Woman Pez dispenser, my Linda Carter Wonder Woman Pez dispenser that sits right in the front no matter what. And those that know me well know that I have been a Wonder Woman person, enthusiast. Yeah, that's it. A Wonder Woman enthusiast for my whole life.
That's great. Who is your favorite saint?
Oh, St. Catherine of Alexandria. So, well, nobody will see this, but so today I'm wearing the St. Catherine medal, which I'm not sure if they still give it out. But at the time that I was a student at Chestnut Hill College, the St. Catherine Medal was given to the sophomore or junior who most clearly exemplified the high ideals of a Catholic college education. And so it was, at the time, it was a very big deal to get the St. Catherine Medal. And St. Catherine of Alexandria, among other things, is patron saint of professors.
Oh, I love that, Tia. And I love, you guys can't see it out there in listener land, but she held it up to the screen. I love that. Tia, what's your favorite movie?
So my all-time favorite movie is West Side Story. But I do have a lot of movies that I love, including Gaslight and The Philadelphia Story and anything with Jodie Foster. And also, if it's a musical, I'll give it a shot.
How about your favorite Philly sports team?
Oh, gosh. You really had to ask me that because, you know, they cause so much pain sometimes. Let's go with the Eagles. Yeah.
Nice. You consume a lot of media, Tia. Do you have a podcast or a book or something that you would recommend to our listeners?
So a podcast that I have enjoyed since the very beginning is called The Sporkful. And so the tagline is, the Sporkful is not for foodies, it's for eaters. That's been a favorite of mine since it first started, I think more than 10 years ago now.
Love it.
Do you have a favorite church hymn or song?
When it's time for, you know, lift high the cross, I do get a little excited, which might be surprising as much as I tell people how powerful and wonderful a tool Lead Me, Guide Me is. So that's one that quickly comes to mind, but there are many that I love. Gift of Finest Wheat has always been my favorite communion hymn. That one you don't hear as much as you did when I was growing up, but yeah. And of course, you know, On Eagle's Wings.
Mm-hmm. And Tia, one last question. If you could have a conversation with anyone besides us, who would it be?
Living or dead?
Living mm-hmm. or dead.
Mm-hmm. My great-grandmother, Myrtle Aguillard. My Nana died quite a while ago at this point. And my Nana, when I started doing this work, she was in the throes of dementia. So I could not ask her the questions that I wanted to ask her. And I wish I had known to ask her a few years earlier when she could have answered them. And so now if I could ask her those questions now about our family, about her life, about why she made some of the decisions she made that had such a dramatic impact on how our family turned out. I would love to do that.
Well, Tia, thank you so much for that sharing, but for all of this sharing. It's been a gift to be in conversation with you and really share from the depths of our heart and hear about all the things that, you know, give you life and call forth more life in the world. So thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Beyond the Habit. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, be sure to tell a friend and subscribe so that you never miss an episode. We appreciate any kind reviews you'd like to leave us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram, or send us an email at beyondthehabitpod@gmail.com.
Thank you to our guest, Dr. Tia Noelle Pratt, for being in conversation with us today. Thank you also to all those who have made this podcast possible, especially our sisters from the Congregation of St. Joseph and the Sisters of St. Joseph of Philadelphia. Our sound editor, Angie Hayes, and our music composer, Matthew Dolan, our producer, Elizabeth Powers, and our podcast coordinator, Sister Sarah Simmons.
We look forward to sharing more with you next time.
Thanks. Bye.
But, you know, all that stuff that you said, now I know why I'm so tired.